From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor Dan Hedaya on starring as President Nixon in the new Watergate spoof Dick. Hedaya admits he was surprised to be picked to play the former president, saying as a Jewish-American actor from Brooklyn, what's the connection? He's best known for his roles as the father in the film Clueless and the ex-husband in The First Wives Club. And the adventures of Randy Wayne White. He was attacked in Peru by knife-wielding thugs, ran cars off the road in driving school, and took Viagra just because he was curious. His new book, The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua, features a collection of his adventures. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the reissue of Indo Jazz Suite. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Federal disaster officials are heading to Utah, where a rare tornado struck downtown Salt Lake City early this afternoon, killing one person and injuring dozens. The governor has declared a state of emergency. From member station KUER in Salt Lake City, Kat Snow reports.
The tornado ripped through the city center just after 1 o'clock, shredding some downtown structures and leaving whole trees scattered on the ground. A segment of the roof on the Delta Center, home of the Utah Jazz basketball team, peeled up like an orange. Dozens of people suffered injuries from flying debris in the 100-mile-per-hour winds. Salt Lake City Mayor Dede Corradini says the damage to nearby residential areas is extensive.
You can just follow the damage on the roof lines of houses, a lot of roof damage, some homes that are severely damaged, including one home where the entire roof is just totally off the house, and you can look down into every room in the house.
FEMA Director James Lee Witt is expected to cut short his vacation and arrive within days, according to Utah Senator Orrin Hatch's office. For NPR News, I'm Kat Snow in Salt Lake City.
The man accused of wounding five people at a Jewish community center in Los Angeles yesterday has turned himself in to police in Las Vegas. Authorities say 37-year-old Buford Furrow will also be charged in the murder of a postal worker shot yesterday near the community center. Investigators believe Furrow was acting alone, and they've discovered he has a history of instability and violence. Steve Kruger of member station KPLU has this report.
Buford O'Neill Furrow had gone to the Fairfax Psychiatric Hospital near Seattle seeking help for depression. He told workers that he was considering suicide and had thought about shooting people at a nearby shopping center. He eventually became agitated with staff and pulled a knife, waving it 18 inches in front of one worker's face. Police were called and Furrow was arrested at gunpoint. Court documents say a 9mm handgun was found in his truck. Furrow was convicted of assault. He served 5 months of an 8-month sentence before being released this spring. Furrow has close ties to racist hate groups in the Pacific Northwest. He was photographed wearing a Nazi uniform at an Aryan Nations rally in Idaho and married the widow of the founder of The Order, a neo-Nazi group from Washington State. For NPR News, I'm Steve Kruger in Seattle.
The 15-year-old boy accused of opening fire on classmates in Conyers, Georgia last May will be tried as an adult. A juvenile court judge ruled that society's need to prevent school shootings outweighed the need to protect suspect T.J. Solomon. The teenager could face life in prison if convicted. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials rose 132 points today to end the day at 10,787. Trading was active. 783 million shares changed hands. This is NPR News in Washington. The latest report from the Federal Reserve finds the U.S. economy growing strongly, with labor shortages in almost all regions. The so-called Beige Book finds no evidence of broad-based wage or price increases. Federal Reserve governors will take a close look at it when they meet later this month to decide whether to raise interest rates. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration says management at a chemical plant in Allentown, Pennsylvania, should be held accountable for an explosion in February that killed five people and injured 13. From member station WHYY, Martin Wells reports.
The cause of the blast at Concept Sciences has still not been determined, but OSHA says it occurred inside a large fiberglass tank that contained about 750 pounds of the hazardous chemical hydroxylamine. OSHA decided to cite the company for a willful violation, the highest level of violation OSHA has, because Concept Sciences failed to train employees in the operational procedures and hazards of the chemical. OSHA spokeswoman Pat Dugan.
The head of OSHA has stated that that is the most troubling aspect of this case, is that CSI management didn't provide the pertinent information to their employees on the hazards involved in this production process.
OSHA is fining Concept Sciences just over $640,000. A spokeswoman says the company will appeal. For NPR News, I'm Martin Wells in Philadelphia.
Former President Gerald Ford returned to the White House today, 25 years after being thrust into the office of president by the Watergate scandal. He was one of eight people to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom. President Clinton praised Ford for ending the national nightmare of Watergate. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. 25 years ago this week, Richard Nixon became the first president to resign from office rather than face impeachment from abuses related to the Watergate break-in. There have been sober interviews commemorating the anniversary and one screwball movie. Dick offers a satiric take on what brought down the Nixon presidency. In the film, two ditzy teenagers, Betsy and Arlene, are unsuspecting witnesses to the Watergate break-in, and on a school trip to the White House, recognize one of the burglars, G. Gordon Liddy. Liddy, played by Harry Shearer, hauls them in for interrogation where they meet the president. Nixon makes them the official White House dog walkers so he can keep an eye on them. In the process, one of the girls, Arlene, develops a crush on him. As the plot thickens, the two girls make a late-night phone call.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. President, this is Arlene.
Oh. Yeah, hello, Arlene, yeah.
I'm not waking you.
No. I'm a night owl.
Oh, yeah, what's the deal with that Watergate thing? Do you know anything about it?
Oh, no, absolutely nothing. I don't know a thing. No way, Jose.
Oh, because I live in the Watergate, and one time we saw that Liddy guy there, and then we saw him at the White House, and now he's going to go to jail.
Arlene, is there something I can do for you or your family?
No.
There must be something you desire.
I have to go now. Good night. My sweet prince.
Dan Hedaya plays the role of Nixon in Dick. His name may not be familiar, but his face sure is. He's a character actor who's appeared in many movies and TV shows. He played the indulgent father in Clueless, the B.B. Rebozo character in Oliver Stone's Nixon, Carla's loser husband in Cheers, a detective in The Usual Suspects, and Bette Midler's lout of a husband in The First Wives Club. I asked Dan Hedaya about his reaction when his agent said they wanted him to play Richard Nixon in Dick.
I said, what do you mean? What are you talking about? What, me? Why would they, you know... I said, does the guy know that I'm a Jew from Brooklyn? He says, well, they want you. Think about it. So they sent the screenplay, and I read it, and I liked it very much. But it didn't assuage my nervousness about the whole idea of, I didn't want to do something that would be a little silly or make like a comic that's been done so many times. So, of course, the first thing I did, of course, to me, you don't know, but I called my buddy Al Sutton, who's a friend for 40 years. I said, Al, they want me to do Nixon, and what am I going to do? It's, how am I going to speak like that? He says, do it. I said, what do you mean, do it? It's easy for you to say. He's not an actor. He said, do it. It'll be fun, do it. He persisted. I said, all right, I'm going to do it. I called, and I spoke to the director, and I told him again. I reminded him of my heritage and my place of birth. And he said, don't worry about it. And I accepted.
Were you reluctant because you were a Jew from Brooklyn and you didn't think a Jew from Brooklyn could do Nixon?
No. Yeah, well, I was just really the voice, to tell you the truth. To get to speak, in a way that is... obviously, like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not a crook. How would that be? Would that be Nixon?
You need more than that.
I had to do it. So he got me a coach. And he came over to my house. And literally within 1 hour, I was speaking Richard Nixon. I don't know what happened, Marty. Something clicked. And I was irrepressible. People had to shut me up. Something happened, and I had no fear anymore. I couldn't wait to go from scene to scene.
Well, was it a matter of just finding where in your throat you could come up with Richard Nixon's voice?
I don't know if it was I didn't know technically. He told me a few things technically, and then I guess from years of watching and something, I don't know what it is. But he helped me immensely, and... you should try it someday. You really get the tapes. I think anybody probably could do it. And
anyone can do Richard Nixon?
I don't know. I'm just saying that it's fun.
Why?
He's got it's a kind of, I don't know why my voice, I was able to feel comfortable, because that was a very big concern.
Well, this is just a person who has been parodied by so many people, whether they're comedians,
yes,
or played by Anthony Hopkins in the movie.
Yes.
Nixon, I would think it'd be a challenge to make it your own.
Well, that's, of course, was in my mind to, just try to, even though it's a comedy, if you extract certain scenes in the movie, they are very serious, very dramatic. Some are filled with vileness and anger. And if you extracted them, they could be from any drama, because I tried to do it in a real way, and try to create something that was not a parody, even though I had a great deal of fun. Some of the sections, like I'm a Jew, and he was anti-Semite. Well, I didn't realize the extent of it. On some of the tapes, he made some vile references to Jews, which, if I saw him in person, I'd want to bang him on the head. And I told the director, I'm not going to say these things. I made one reference because it's part of the history. It was hard. It was agitating.
You're talking about the arrogance and the malevolence of Richard Nixon. But I have to say, I felt a kind of sweetness. It wasn't always there, but a little bit of a sweetness in your performance. Am I hallucinating?
Well, no, you're not hallucinating, because that's just, the part that I was referring to is not in any way to be make any kind of apology at all. But I tried to. He was vulnerable, and he was so, I guess the most honest part of him was his paranoia, in a way. And it made him scared, and it made him... sensitive, if you can call it that. He was injured by all these things that were happening, even though he, his actions caused them to happen to him. And I'm sure the man had, he loved his children, and he loved his wife, and he had friends, and he cared for the country, and he cared, he had principles, but that doesn't exonerate him from the bad stuff. So that part of it, you can't just do, make a person who is just completely black, and he was a human being. Mm-hmm. And I must say, there are times when I watched him where I almost felt guilty, but I liked the guy at certain times when I watched him.
What was it like on the set? And, we've been talking about the kind of serious part of Richard Nixon, but this movie is very much a send-up, not just of Nixon, but of all the people around him, and in Woodward and Bernstein, who are, of course, hot on his tail.
Yes. Well, the set was completely one of the most enjoyable times I've had, and maybe reflective of that is the last night of filming. We did a scene starting at 11 o'clock, and it should have ended at 11:30. I think it ended about 1:30. The reason, it was Kissinger and Nixon in the Oval Office, and Saul Rubinek is Kissinger. He's wonderful, wonderful. And he Nixon asks Saul, Henry, will you pray with me? And the minute I kneeled down, we had to kneel down in the Oval Office, and Saul would look at me, and I'd look at Saul, and uncontrollable laughter.
Really? You couldn't get
and
through
it
the
went
scene?
On. We finally did at 2 o'clock, and that amount of fun was present through all of it.
That's Dan Hedaya, our guest today on Fresh Air. He plays Richard Nixon in the new movie Dick, which is a satire of the Watergate saga. I want to talk a little bit about your life. You grew up in Brooklyn, in a Syrian community in Brooklyn.
Syrian Jewish, Sephardic Jewish community, yeah. In Brooklyn, in Bay Parkway. There's an area on a beautiful block. All the families knew each other and played ball. And, of course, there was not too much traffic. You could play stickball, football. I used to spend hours in the winter, throwing the ball up in the sky. I played baseball, catches, snowball fights, walks, hanging out on the, we used to call it the stoop.
What were you like as a kid?
The way I am now.
Which is?
I don't know. It's not for me to say.
I mean, were you a troublemaker? Were you a
kid? No, I don't think so.
Regular?
I love regular person. I loved sports a lot, and I was not too much of a good student. I was very. They called me actually the first word that when I went to this other school, the social studies teacher said to me, "You know what you are?" I said, "No." He says, "You're peripatetic." That was the first big word I learned.
It's not a bad thing to be called. You're everywhere, right?
You're everywhere. You can't sit still, and I'm still
a little peripatetic.
There's a certain element of that, right. And restless soul, mm-hmm. and but more calm. But I played ball. I had friends. I was used to go to synagogue and sit next to my father, which was a very peaceful time. He was a gentle sweetheart of a man. He passed away, but I have very abiding love for him. And my mother just turned 91.
Wow.
And she's a wonderful, lives in Brooklyn.
Was your family religious? I mean, you went to synagogue,
well,
but was it more than that?
We were in the Orthodox tradition, and there was a time when I was pretty religious, I guess the time of about 11 to 16, and then I went to the Merchant Marines and everything came crashing down.
Well, you said you joined the Merchant Marine at the age of 16.
I went summers. I was, and that was a very expansive kind of milestone experience, because suddenly you're on a huge ship and you're working amongst men on the deck and the crew. In fact, when I remember I picked up my first ship, a tanker, in Baltimore, and when I went there by myself, I was standing on the deck with this guy who they said I was going to live with, big tall guy, I was a kid, and the ship started moving, and the sound of the tugboat, and I was so excited, and I kind of nudged him from my, enthusiasm. I said, "Wow, we're moving." Now, this is a hardened veteran seaman. He looked at me. He said, "Don't you ever touch me again, boy." I said, "Okay." This is, don't you, that was the beginning. So I lost my, I kept my enthusiasm private from then on.
But did you want to see the world? Was that
part of
the lure of the Merchant Marine?
Yes. I really, it's an unbelievable, unbelievable experience. And I made three trips, and I guess that stirred my wanderlust, which is still today a very strong pleasure for me.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a very short break. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Dan Hedaya. He plays President Richard Nixon in the new movie, The Satire Dick. He's also appeared in many other films, TV programs as well. And we'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Dan Hedaya, and he's in the new movie Dick. In fact, plays the role of President Richard Nixon. You went to Tufts University, is that right, in Boston? Did you go there to study acting, to study theater?
No, I just went there. What do I mean? In the school, everybody was applying to colleges. You know, you get caught in the frenzy, I applied to two schools, and they accepted me at this university, and I was in college. That was it, and I majored in liberal arts, and then I just finished school. And then didn't know what to do. I became a teacher in New York City.
Yeah, junior high school teacher, English teacher.
English and a couple of math classes, you know. Long division examples. You put about 20 of them on the board and let the kids do them.
So how many years did you teach?
Probably seven.
Oh, wow.
Six or seven. Wow. Yeah.
So you really put in some time.
Yeah. I guess the real turning point is when I started to think about acting, taking classes, because Al Sutton's sister Barbara told me she was taking acting classes, and why didn't I come? It's fun. So I went, and I started liking it again, because I did a few plays in college, and then I started to pursue it, and then I said, literally, I said, I'm either going to not do it or do it. I decided, yes, I'm going to do it, which meant no more teaching, because you have to free up the daytime. For potential appointments.
So what did you like about acting? What hooked you?
I don't really know. It's hard to say. It's fun. It's certainly a privilege. I think without getting fancy, it's sort of like a tropism in the sense of since I never really planned anything or thought about it. As a career, it almost feels like a kind of natural gravitating towards. And then, when you start doing it, it's fun. It's different. It is a chance for a form of expression, that's it. And then you're doing it. That's what you're doing.
I'm interested in how you hooked up with the Coen brothers. You were in one of their very early films, Blood Simple. And I don't know at that age how many people knew who the Coen brothers were.
I think the Coen brothers knew who they were.
That was about it.
Yeah.
Well, what did you think? What did you think about that?
I really, again, it was, in retrospect, it was a job. They called me and they said, there's this movie in Texas. It's Scale. If scale means that it's the lowest amount they can pay you, according to the union. But scale usually means it has some artistic, special artistic merit. That's how they often try to lure you and pay you nothing. I just went to meet them, and I did meet them, and that was it. And I probably forgot about it within 5 minutes. And then time went by, and I got another call. They want to meet you again, and it was a Saturday. I wasn't feeling well, so I was grumbling about it to a friend. I said, "What am I going to go? It's a Scale movie in Texas. I don't feel good." So maybe it was Al again, but I did.
I'm glad I did.
I went and I met them and they offered me the part. But when we did it in Texas, it was on a shoestring, and many of the kids who were helping in the movie were from the University of Texas, apprentices. It was a completely un-Hollywood experience. Just these two brothers and a nice bunch of people, Fran McDormand, who subsequently married Joel. And we did it, and that was it. Then I didn't even think it would ever come out, honestly.
I think a film that really, if people haven't been following your career, the one that the role that you played that got a lot of attention was the father, the Beverly Hills attorney and overprotective dad in the film Clueless. And
protective, not overprotective.
I guess it depends on your style. But
yeah, yeah.
It's a great part, though. I mean, he's such a likable guy.
Yeah, protective. He cares about his so many fathers. Have told me there's when he says to this guy who comes over to take her out, and he's a wise guy. I don't know if you remember, he was a real wise guy. He had this attitude like a punk. And he said, if you don't bring her back on time and safely, he said, I have a 45 and a shovel, and I don't think anybody's going to miss you.
I think those are words that every parent can relate to.
I've been dying to say that. You know, 45, and it was a beautiful, funny, it was a beautiful line, but I think also reflects what should be the sentiment.
Hey, man. Nice pile of bricks you got here.
You drink?
No, thanks, I'm cool.
I'm not offering, I'm asking you if you drink. You think I give alcohol to teenage drivers taking my daughter out?
Hey, man, the protective vibe, I dig.
What's with you, kid? You think the death of Sammy Davis left an opening in the Rat Pack? Cher, get in here.
What's up, Daddy?
What the hell is that?
A dress.
Says who?
Calvin Klein.
It looks like underwear. Go upstairs and put something over it.
Yeah, I was just going to.
Hey, you. Anything happens to my daughter, I got a 45 and a shovel. I doubt anybody would miss you.
And that's Dan Hedaya from the film Clueless. You live in New York City now. Move there from Los Angeles.
Move from New York to Los Angeles and bolted.
And bolted, why? Why did you bolt?
Yeah, you bolt, believe me. You go out there.
Tell me.
It's just not for me. It was good living there, but then it gets a little bit lonely. I broke up with somebody and didn't have too many friends out there, and it's... As my friend Lou would say, it's deadly. So I like to go there now and work and just come back and stay in New York.
Do you go back and visit your old childhood neighborhood in Brooklyn?
No.
No?
No. Mm-mm.
Don't feel the urge?
Although I should. You're right. I'm going to go back when I go back.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dan Hedaya.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us
today on Fresh Air. Been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Actor Dan Hedaya plays Richard Nixon in the new movie, Dick. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Arts. And from Reel.com. An online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Viagra Blues, Rebel Attacks, and Fishing. Just some of the adventures we'll hear about with writer Randy Wayne White. He has a new book, which is a collection of war stories from his travels. And Kevin Whitehead reviews Indo Jazz Suite. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. Randy Wayne White likes offbeat adventures. He took a crash course in flying and put a Marchetti fighter through its paces with rolls and loop-de-loops and a pseudo dogfight. He took his life in his hands diving for used golf balls in an alligator-infested pond at a posh country club. And feeling a little homesick, he hooked up with an eccentric running group in Bangkok who called themselves a drinking club with a running problem. These stories and others are collected in White's new book, The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua. White lives in Florida, where he writes his very popular Doc Ford mystery novels. He had a column in Men's Health and Outside magazines. Now he writes occasional pieces for Outside. One of the stories in his new book is about White taking driving lessons at an anti-terrorism driving school in Virginia. I asked him to describe the program.
I got to this school, and it is a seven-day intensive course. It goes from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., 7 days a week. Now, I suspect, like most people, I thought I was a competent driver. Marty, I'm not even close. The men and sometimes women who went through this school are, I can't tell you what they do because they couldn't tell me. Presumably they work for the State Department in some way in the military. I know some Navy SEALs went through the school. And in the course of those 7 days, the only time I wasn't terrified was at lunch. I was a little uneasy at lunch too. But we learned how to ram cars off the road. We literally did that. Cars would pull out of the side roads and chase us, shooting guns at us, trying to run us off the road. We learned how to do boot turns, J turns. It's all in the book. It amazes me I made it through.
One of the things you said you learned was positive ocular response, driving, barricade, breaching. What were these things?
Positive ocular response is typically obtuse government term for looking where you want to go. And that really is what it means. When you go into a slide, you know how you've been on ice, I suspect, in a car, and you start to slide and you see a tree and you go, oh my gosh, I don't want to hit the tree, I don't want to hit the tree, and you're looking at the tree, well, guess what you're going to hit? You're going to hit the tree. So when you start to slide, you look, oh, I want to go there. I want to go where there's no tree. Go where there's no tree, and then you'll go where there's no tree. That's the whole theory.
And normally they teach what, business people, government people, how to evade if a terrorist is on their tail, that kind of thing?
They teach you how to turn an automobile into a weapon, which unfortunately too many people know how to do already. But it is, if you're under attack, turn the tables and put a little rubber on them, as they say at the school.
Well, the whole philosophy of this group was to help you be aware of terrorists that might be lurking here and there. Did you feel safer or more at risk once you graduated from the school? Did you believe now
safer.
That terrorists were actually in hiding, waiting for you?
I felt safer because my job is to go. They essentially, editors pick out some third world hellhole, and I go there. And if I get back safely, I write about it. And that's my job. So I felt safer because I've been so many places where I've had rental cars and where there are terrorists. And I've been in terrorist attacks. And it is, I tend to joke around, but all joking aside, to be in a situation where there actually is violence. And I've been in that situation in Peru. I've been in that situation in Nicaragua and Cambodia. To be in a place where there actually is violence is a stunning, stunning experience. It's not like on weekday television where you see somebody shot and you move along your merry way and have a cappuccino. And it is, if you see real violence, you are set back for weeks.
Tell us what happened. I mean, you said Peru, Nicaragua. What happened that you were in the middle of a terrorist attack or observed one?
Peru. I was assigned to take the highest train trip in the world. The train goes from Lima, which is close to sea level, to Huancayo, which goes up over 16,000 feet. And I'm from Florida, and I live on an Indian mound. My daily elevation is about 13 feet. So I took this train, and it was supposed to be a pretty funny story because even the Indios on this train, the rapid transition from sea level to 16,000 feet, even the Indios become unwell and they send a woman in a white smock up and down the aisles with this bladder filled with oxygen, and she squirts this thing in your face, and it's supposed to make you feel better. Now, for me, the transition from sea level to 16,000 feet, I did not get nauseous. Maybe it's because I'm an old fishing guide. But what elevation and altitude does to me is it makes me mean, and thank goodness, because I'm normally such a sweet and gentle-hearted guy.
Makes you mean?
It made me very grumpy, very impatient. In Huancayo, when I arrived, by coincidence, this small village in the mountains was having its 416th anniversary. Music in the little village square, llamas, people playing flutes. I thought, geez, what a fun little town. And I was standing there, this was about dusk, watching this little festival going on. Two guys came up and they kind of bumped into me, and they looked at me and they spit on my boots. Now, I'm a pretty big guy, and I looked at this guy like, you couldn't possibly have meant to do that. And the guy looked at me like, yeah, we really meant to do that. And about an hour later, I was walking down a side street. It was right after sunset. And I heard two people coming up behind me. And these were two different guys because they were bigger. And they came up. I moved aside for them to pass. And I felt such an impact on my back. It drove me forward. I caught myself on a railing. And the sidewalk we were on was elevated off the street by about 2 or 3 feet. And I turned around and I hit the one guy so hard it knocked them both into the street. And they gave me the strangest look. Thinking about it now, the hair, what little hair I have, comes up in my neck. And they got up and they walked and then started to run. And I ran the other way, got back to my hotel, took off my vest. And in the back of my vest where I had my notebook, there was a rip. I took out my notebook. And there was a stab mark in it. And that's why they gave him the strange look. They couldn't figure out why I wasn't hurt.
And you had your notebook in your back, up your shirt.
Well, it gets worse. 1 hour later, and I mean, I was shaking after that. These guys just walked up and stabbed me. And 1 hour later, I heard an explosion. And the Shining Pass and Daryl Luminoso attacked the village. And that attack went on for 7 hours. Part of the hotel was blown up I was in. I saw a man shot right in our doorway. It was extraordinary.
Do you think?
And that's why in my novels, I write novels about a Florida marine biologist. Right. And some people will criticize me saying there's so little violence. And my reply is, if you've actually seen violence, you know how it affects people. And you don't use it often.
Do you think they targeted you because you were so obviously an American, or you were just...
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
1 week later in that same town, a U.S. agronomy student from Florida was traveling down the same street I was on, and they pulled him from his car, made him kneel down. They shot him in the back of his head.
Well, let me reintroduce you, and that's Randy Wayne White, our guest today on Fresh Air. He's a writer. He's got a new book. It's called The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua, and it's stories of some of his adventures around the world, some of his travel experiences, fishing as well. You're a fairly accomplished fishing guide. You did this for some time, I guess, before you turned to writing, or maybe along the same time of that. How did you get into fishing? Because one of the things that you say in writing about that is that you never intended this. You never really liked to fish.
You know, I didn't. I had a very curious life, Marty. I was a fishing guide full-time on Sanibel Island for 13 years, Sanibel Island, Florida.
That means taking people out fishing, right? I mean,
correct, yes. In a small boat. My boats ranged in size from 19 feet to 24 feet. And I was a light tackle guide. I did more than 3,000 charters.
Hmm. Were you a good guide? You say in the beginning you weren't particularly good, but did you become a good guide?
I became certainly a competent guide and held at least one world record on fly rod, specialized in saltwater fly fishing. I think certain people, men and women, have great instincts for fishing.
Yeah.
There aren't many. Many people lie about those instincts. I never had great instincts, but I certainly had a work ethic. On the days I wasn't paid to fish, I went out and fished my own.
And you like the sea. I mean, you like the sea as well, certainly the way you write about it, that there's something very attractive about.
I like the water. I'm a waterman, and I've never felt at one with the sea. I can tell you that right now. It's frightened me. I found it haunting. I found it existential. I found it but never warm and welcoming, I can tell you that. But I enjoyed my years as a guide to be on the water, as I was 300 days a year, to be on the water at first light, catching bait, and the qualities of wind and the odors and textures of light sticks with you.
Does fishing make you a better writer because you have to be so observant?
I think all the bills I get make me a better writer, truthfully. Unfortunately, my novels do very well, the Doc Ford books. But
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. I know I enjoyed guiding. I'll tell you a quick fishing guide story. My job, as I told you, was to take people fishing. And one day down to the docks came this couple, very old, it seemed to me at that time. They were probably 55, 60, and I'm 48 now. Got in my boat, I'm taking out the small bay, and the man nudges me and said, "We don't want to fish." I said, "Well, sir, I can do that. I cannot take you fishing." He goes, "You don't understand. This is our 30th wedding anniversary. In all our lives, we've dreamed about coming to Florida and being left alone on a deserted island." Now, I know what this old goat had in mind. So I ran him up to a deserted island, beautiful coconut palms, white beach, dropped him off, came back. And he said, "Come back in 2 hours," which impressed the hell out of me, Marty. Came back 2 hours. They were standing there waiting on me in water up to the necks. And I said, "It's time to go." And the woman in this terrible falsetto wails, "We can't ever leave. The tide came in, took all our clothes away." Now, I was rigged to fish. I didn't have a boarding ladder. And by the time I got that woman in my boat, I knew her a lot better than I wanted to know her, I'll tell you that. They didn't have a stitch.
That's great. Well, I'll tell you what, I do want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And our guest is Randy Wayne White, and he's got a new book of stories about some of his adventures traveling the world, fishing as well. It's called The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Randy Wayne White, and he has a new book of stories called The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua. One of the things you say in the beginning of the book, which I found quite interesting, is the feeling that Americans have that the world hates them. Your feeling and experience as you travel the world is that the world is crazy about Americans, that we have this inferiority complex.
Boy, we are a strange bunch. We denigrate, we self-denigrate, and self-criticize, and the ugly American. Now, I have in all my travels, I've seen a couple of ugly Americans, but not many. We are so quick to take blame. "Oh, I'm sorry, it's my fault." That's my experience. And my experience also, with the exception of Peru, where I got stabbed, is that people love Americans. We're popular, they want to hang around us, they want to go do stuff with us. A quick example, I flew to Hanoi from Bangkok, jet lagged. It's a long cab ride from the airport into town, and got at my hotel probably at 2 a.m., couldn't sleep, got up, it was foggy. I decided to go for a jog. Took off jogging through the mist, through this fog, through several parks. After about an hour, I was ready to head back to the hotel. And Marty, I had this terrible realization. I didn't know what hotel I was staying at. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any identification. And I was completely lost. Now, luckily, about after 2 hours of looking for my hotel, I walked past an open bar, and there was an Australian there. And I said, "Can you help me?" I was almost in tears by this time. "Can you help me? I'm lost." "All right, mate. No worries. We can take care of that, right?" And we got these little cyclos, these pedal bicycles, and we went all over Hanoi looking for my hotel, and we would go in, and I'd go, "Am I staying here?" And by the end of that day, it seemed like I knew everybody in Hanoi, and they loved me. I was an American, and that was before it was illegal to go to Vietnam, and that was true in Vietnam. It was true in Cambodia. It's been true all through Central America, particularly in Nicaragua and Cuba. I was in Cuba 12 days, brought back 147 refugees during Mariel Harbor.
Huh.
People, in my experience, right, love American Americans.
And I imagine in Hanoi you were not known as the American, but that crazy American that doesn't know where he is.
Well, that one day in the hotel, some woman came in and, very broken English said, where is Mr. America? I was very flattered.
You wrote an article, or a series of articles, actually, for Men's Health magazine, and it was called Guys Like Us, a column in the magazine. One of the things that you wrote, and this was actually in April of this year, which I found pretty funny. Middle age is what military experts might describe as a, quote, target-rich environment. And as a self-described middle-aged man, you feel like you're a pretty big target.
Well, yeah, and I think it's that thing, middle-aged crazy. It's become trivialized. Oh, he got a wig and a sports car. He's acting like a young idiot. Marty, it is not trivial. It is, for some of us, it's debilitating. For other of us, it's deadly. And it's an important time of life. For me, it's been a wonderful time of life. But I have seen friends absolutely devastated. And that's why I wanted to write those columns for Men's Health. And I just, my attorney agent's just sending out a proposal to write a book on middle age, which I very much look forward to do. And the working title is You're Over 40, Fat Boy. And it will, for once, tell the truths of middle age that I've never read, how we really do see ourselves in terms of our relationships with women. How idiotic we are to have affairs, although almost all of us do it. It has ruined so many lives, so many families. Panic attacks. You know, we wake up at 2, 3 a.m., our hearts pounding, worried about all the people for whom we're responsible. It can be a very tough time of life. It's a funny time of life as well, but it's at any rate, it's a book I look forward to writing.
And the title, including the word fat boy, I mean, do you feel like a fat boy?
I look so darn good right now, Marty. yeah, because we kind of get fat. Your whole body changes. It's a real pisser. You know, I have back problems. I fight it every single day. I work out twice a day every day. I lift weights. I swim, all this stuff. Play long toss with a baseball, and the entire battle is against essentially against gravity.
Well, talking about middle age, you have a pretty funny piece that you wrote about the time you took Viagra. Mm. And again, just reading a couple things from it, I mean, the physical effects beyond the obvious ones was, you know, your cheeks were flushed and your vision was blurred and on and on and on and on. You want to tell us what happened?
Yeah, well, as I wrote, geez, what a dangerous drug. First it screws up your vision, then it gives you an erection. It's very, very dangerous. But the worst thing about that story was the magazine also had me try Muse, which is a more serious, it's a penile implant. It's a thing you put up. And the magazine had the Viagra tablets. They sent me three, two of which I give to guys on my baseball team. But they said...
Did that make you very popular on your team?
It did with the wives, I'll tell you. But they said, but the Muse, if you have a doctor friend, you need to get a prescription because we don't have this stuff. And I said, well, my best friend's a cardiac surgeon. I can call him, but I don't know what's a cardiac surgeon going to be writing a script for Muse. So I called him. And I said, can you get this stuff for me? He goes, well, if you want it. But
now,
so a week or two passes, and... the magazine calls, and I said, did you get the Muse? I said, oh, yeah, my buddy's going to get it for me. I call my buddy. I go, did you get the Muse, this penile implant stuff? He goes, I didn't get it, but I called in the prescription. I said, where? And I live on an island. He said, to the island pharmacy. I went, oh, no. I go to this little tiny pharmacy on the small island where I live, and I walk in. I'm immediately sweating. And it's like a kid going in to buy condoms. And there are three women behind the counter. And one woman says to me, aren't you Randy White, the novelist? I just loved your last book, and I'm sweating. I can't stop sweating. I think I'm just going to buy a comb and some chewing gum and get out of here. And I hear this paper rattle. And she goes, oh, Mr. White, we have a prescription for you. Oh. Oh.
This is her, right?
It was absolutely humiliating. And to this, I don't know what kind of stories are circulating about me on that island, but it...
Now, I have to ask you, though, but how did they convince you to try this penile implant?
Oh, well, no, it's like a little pill you stick up there. No, no, it's not.
Oh,
no,
okay.
Lord, no, no,
No,
it's just like a little pill. And I didn't even have a partner, and the whole thing was a nightmare. And, of course, you can't go anywhere. You're just sticking around. Oh, it's awful.
Randy Wayne White's new book is The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua. Coming up, Indo Jazz Suite. This is Fresh Air. In the mid-1960s, the West discovered the classical music of India. The Beatles were hanging out with Ravi Shankar, the Yardbirds were playing raga rock, and a lot of sitars and tablas got sold to rock musicians who never learned how to play them. Jazz had its flirtations as well. John Coltrane wrote an atmospheric drone named India, and Ravi Shankar collaborated with Bud Shank and Paul Horn. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead remembers a 1965 attempt to fuse jazz and Indian music, masterminded by composer John Mayer and saxophonist Joe Harriott in England.
On first glance, it's a natural match. Jazz and South Indian classical music both value improvisation and rhythmic vitality. The problem is, they approach those concepts from different directions. By the mid-1970s, a few jazz musicians, like guitarist John McLaughlin and saxophonist John Handy, had figured out how to blend with Indian traditional musicians. One of the first attempts to marry the two came in 1965. The Indo Jazz Suite was a collaboration between Anglo-Indian composer John Mayer and the Anglo-West Indian saxophonist Joe Harriott, one of the pioneers of European free jazz. Each fronted a quintet of musicians representing their respective traditions. Sensing the potential for cross-cultural confusion, John Mayer wrote out a lot of material, including all the flute parts, leaving little to chance. John Mayer's pieces echo various aspects of South Indian music, but in a stylized and regimented way. In one sense, the composer achieves the worst of both worlds. He makes the Indian musicians simplify their involved rhythms and asks the jazz musicians to limit themselves to a specific scale while improvising. Even so, in the process, Mayer invents something that resembles neither inspiration but has its own naive charm. In that respect, the Indo Jazz Suite harks back to the 1950s and the bachelor pad exotica of fake Polynesian music. Yet the complex but unyielding rhythm patterns anticipate future trends like reggae dub records and 90s drum and bass beats. Even weirder, Mayer occasionally steps in to play a little un-Indian, un-jazzy harpsichord. Jazz soloists here, including trumpeter Kenny Wheeler, mostly play by the composer's rules. The suite would sound airless and overdetermined were it not for Joe Harriott, who more than anyone here bends the bylaws. Punching a hole in the concept, he lets in the freshness and unpredictability that is improvisation's forte. Joe Harriott and John Mayer refined their Indo-Jazz fusion concept after the Indo-Jazz Suite, but that first tentative step was prophetic. Composer Mayer anticipated the first phase of the world music movement when he forged a common musical language by simplifying everyone's grammar. But saxophonist Joe Harriott apprehended the deeper truth that lets musicians from around the world play together with relative ease nowadays. Real interaction results not from careful scripting, but from improvisers listening to each other and responding on the spot. Come to think of it, that was the method used by John McLaughlin in his Indo-Jazz band Shakti, a decade after Joe Harriott pointed the way.
Kevin Whitehead writes about jazz from Amsterdam. He reviewed the reissue The Indo-Jazz Suite on the Koch label. Fresh Air's senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Queen Mother Century by Robert Lacey, a book of photographs in bookstores everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the life and times of comedian Lenny Bruce. We talk with filmmaker Robert Wydee about his documentary, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, which took him 12 years to complete. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.